All right, so we're on page 46, chapter, or paragraph 16, or section 16. So he says, now, what we did last week was this idea that over demanding, or demanding of the Nefesh HaBahamas more than it can handle, not only isn't successful, but it causes a reaction from an opposite reaction from the Nefesh HaBahamas that seeks to completely overturn what you were doing. This is just like an example of an elephant, that if you force the elephant to do too much, it not only doesn't do it, but it throws the master off and tries to crush him. Meaning that it's more than it doesn't do what you want to do, but it creates an opposite reaction, which is pretty devastating.
In regard to that, what's the fine line between that and doing tshuva for a behavior that you know is wrong and you have to change?
Well, I mean, I'm not sure what you mean, what the fine line is.
Well, at what point does this case we're talking about now take effect from every typical case of wanting to do tshuva for something that you want to correct?
Well, again, I'm not 100% sure what you mean, but I guess that what he's talking about is that when you do tshuva, if you did something wrong, let's say if you slipped up, and you forgot that it was Shabbos, and you got up one morning, you turned on the stereo, or you got into a car, or something like that. So you have to do tshuva for it, but the tshuva is for some act that was done that wasn't a habitual characterological thing, such as, let's say, like sleeping late to the minyan. Like, we know, if you're a minyan goer, that the people come 10 minutes early, come 10 minutes early, whenever it is. The people that come 10 minutes late, come 10 minutes late, whenever it is. Now, the guy that comes 10 minutes late, I mean, he doesn't really want to come 10 minutes late. It is something about his relationship with time and his relationship with being organized and being able to get himself out that causes that. That's a very profound thing to change, because we can be in a shul 20 years and the same guy that comes 10 minutes late comes 10 minutes late for 20 years in a row. Why doesn't he change it? If he tries to, he's got a problem. I mean, and that's, hard. But then when you talk about more difficult things, let's say somebody has a temper. Under certain conditions, he loses his temper. Another person is jealous. Another person speaks not nicely. So when these profoundly habituated behaviors come to your attention, my attention, and we want to change them, then you've got a cheshbon nefesh situation. Because without his approach, you can't do it. Basically, that's what he says, is because you make up to do it, and then it's like you're dealing with the Nefesh HaBahamas, and the Nefesh HaBahamas says, get lost. It's like a yo-yo dieter. He diets, so he just forces himself to eat very little. The result of forcing yourself to eat too little is that you end up gaining more than you lost, and you end up, for most people, this is what the books seem to say, that they end up being heavier than they were before they started the diet. Because the diet, it was an attempt to buck the Nefesh HaBahamas that wasn't very, very carefully planned out, just like you would very, very carefully plan out the training of the elephant.
Well, is he saying that this applies to both habitual behaviors that may be not healthy for a person, but not necessarily a veira, and habitual behaviors that are veiras?
Right. Both? Yeah, yeah.
I mean, one is more of a necessity to correct than the other, I would think.
Yeah, yeah. But, in general, a lot of the more subtle, characterological things, even though they may not involve one of the Taryag Mitzvos, are also considered to be very important. It falls under the general rubric of developing a godlike personality. Mahurachum, Mahvatarachum, Mahuchanon, Mahvatuchanon. It just as Hashem is merciful, we have to be merciful. So we try in our goals of self-perfection to create a personality structure that's most godlike and similar to Hashem. To do that, you often have to bath the Nefesh HaBahamas, just like you have to do it for so many other things. But it's the same basic, the guy that comes 10 minutes late to Minyan, so he probably doesn't get his tefillah b'tzibur. He misses Kadeshim, the first two Kadeshim. If he wants to get his tefillah b'tzibur, he has to skip parts of Psukei Dezimra. So, if it happens one day, something happened. If it happens 20 years in a row, so then that's a serious, that's a very serious thing. In my experience, I basically tend to be a latecomer. It's my nature. Just like to come late. I don't like it. So at a certain point where I was before, I could not get myself to come to shul on time. I just, early enough to be ready at the start of the, when they sound the bell and start with everybody, finish with everybody. So what I did was, I started a Mishnayos shir before davening. So I had 20 minutes to be, the Mishnayos before.
And so I ended Mishnayos shir would run late.
I ended up coming late to the Mishnayos shir very often, but at least I was on time for davening,
Rabbi?
But I'm saying that's the kind of a thing that you can get control over it through a doable mechanism. If you just say, I'm coming on time, that's going to be a very hard thing. You could do a cheshbon nefesh deal, that you try very carefully and you make a chart and then you make it your business to come 9 minutes late or something like that, or to come on time once a week. And then you do once a week, once a week, once a week for a year, and then you habituate once a week. And you go for twice a week. It could be that such a plan would make it doable, but if you just do, you do Al Chayt on Yom Kippur and you say, from now on I'm going to come on time. So it could be that you'll kill yourself for a week and come on time, then after that you'll start coming 15 minutes late, because that's the mechanism that the Cheshbon HaNefesh describes, because the reaction puts the person back further, further behind eight ball than he was when he started, or she was.
It was Shabbos Shuv at Russia in New York, and the rabbi was saying that he saw one guy. He was trying to get people to spend more time, make more time for important things. He says he was driving behind somebody once in the morning, and he sees they're putting their tefillin on one arm, and they get to a light, keeps driving, putting the tefillin on the head, and then he gets to another light, they're putting the tallis on. So, the point was, make more time so you can do this in shul, not in your car.
Right, but the problem is that person probably does the same thing for 20 years in a row. Well, he probably does it for his whole lifetime, because these things are very, very hard to change. There's like an on-time personality to shul, and a 10-minute early, and a 10-minute late, and a half an hour late. And it's incredible how it just keeps going from year to year, from year to year, year to year, from decade to decade. And but this is what the Cheshbon HaNefesh is about, is like how to get a grip on these profoundly habituated behaviors that are deeply embedded in our personality, and how to free ourselves from them. It's very, very hard. Very
difficult. Rabbi?
Yeah.
So, the first thought I had was that it's a question of how much slack you give the elephant, It's like either you hold it right up by its neck, it's going to drag you. You have no control over it.
Well, he says you have to know. It depends on you, or it depends on the elephant, it depends on this.
Yeah.
The point is, it has to be planned very carefully. How much you can do and how much you can't do, he doesn't say. But he said that an expert trainer knows what he can do and what he can't do. And he said, you know, right in the beginning of the Sefer, he said, you know, with this example, he said if he pushes it too hard, it's not good. If he gives it too much slack, it's not good. If he deprives it of food, it's not good. If he overfeeds it and overindulges it, it's not good. All those calculations have to be taken into account before you start training an elephant. So he says that if you want to get to shul on time and not 10 minutes late, so you have the same daunting task. You can't just will yourself to do it. Like I say, if you did tshuva once in your Mechal Shabbos, I mean, if you did an Avera, you did a sin one time and you violated Shabbos, you do tshuva. You did something wrong, you know, you succumbed to temptation and you did some terrible sin once. All right, yeah, it's bad, but it's not part of you. But once you start doing it for years on end, ooh, then changing it, ooh, that's really hard.
So really the first step is to see what the problem is, like what the elephant is doing. Yeah. You have to be able to recognize that, otherwise you won't know how to approach
it. Right, that was in the Hakdama, in the introduction we did in like the first or the second class in the series, we did the Hakdama of Rabbi Isaac Sher, and he says in there that you have to know yourself, because any attempt to change oneself must begin with an understanding of what you are.
Yeah.
Because if you don't know what you are, then how can you go about trying to change anything?
Is there any relationship to the role Hashem played in hardening Pharaoh's heart and him having so much difficulty in changing and us having difficulty in changing? You know, does it really come down to our own free will, or you know, are there forces that we can't control sometimes that are making it hard for us to change?
Well, I think that in the case of Pharaoh, I forget the Mefarshim talk, that's one of the big things that they talk about, like how could Pharaoh be punished for something that he would have recanted from had Hashem not done this to him. So they answer it in a pretty satisfactory way. I believe the Ramban talks about it. The Sephorno, I think the Ramban and or the Sephorno talk about it. But there, the basic situation was that once your life depends on it, then you act differently. So the guy that can't come to shul on time can't come under the same set of motivations. But if suddenly he gets a very aggressive rabbi who says, I'm going to shoot you if you don't come on time, so then he'll come on time. You know, he'll just come on time. So in a sense, that's what Pharaoh had. He had such a new force that was leveled against him that under normal conditions he simply would have just recanted. So Hashem did something to him that gave him the ability to choose whether he wanted to serve Hashem. I think, if I remember correctly, the Ramban says that he took away like the fear of being punished. Because the fear of being punished would have caused him to recant, but the recanting wouldn't have been because of a cognition of Hashem or anything like that. It's just that he wouldn't have the ability to withstand it, because nobody wants to get their head smashed. But if I recant because of my head being smashed, then I'm not repenting, because the second the head isn't being smashed, he's not. So Hashem wanted him to decide on his own that this was a bad thing. So he took away that unnatural fear, and then Pharaoh, with his great rishis, refused to see Hashem. And that's why he kept getting cracked in the head, you know, with these plagues. But with us, we don't have that fear mechanism. And our not doing tshuva, you know, might be akin to Paro's not doing tshuva. I'm not sure. It's a whole different, little bit of a different thing. You know, we're talking about characterological flaws. I mean, there are commentaries that say that there are characterological flaws in Pharaoh. They attribute it to Gaiva. So to arrogance, and his arrogance disallowed him from seeing it, whatever. But, you know, whether the connection, as I explained it to Taro, is or isn't true, but it is fairly clear that that's what he's saying about us, that we have these tendencies that are so amazingly difficult to uproot, and that this is what his program is for, is to allow us to access them and control them.
Rabbi? So, I mean, you have to question whether habits or anything you should... I guess there are two types of habits. There's the ones that you develop consciously, and there's the ones that sort of sneak up on you from behind, and then you have them. And usually the first kind are the good kind, like, you know, when you discipline yourself to do something a certain way, and then the bad ones are the ones that you develop that... But, I mean, the argument could be made that...
And there's also another kind, and that's the kind that you're born with.
Because, really?
Sure, because everyone is born with a different set of personality traits.
But they're not... Those, I mean, that's not how I see it. That's a predisposition, maybe, doing something.
Yeah, so if you have a greater, let's say, the character structure of a person is something that, to a great measure, you inherit. It's in your genes. So they're not all children are not born the same. You know, when you see the same children of a family, like one is nicer, one is not nice, one is energetic, the other one is lazy, one is kind, one is mean spirited, and this is little children, and they just grow up that way, and the characteristics continue. So those, in a sense, are harder to uproot because they're inborn. Other characteristics are acquired. You say there's a difference between something that sneaks up on you and that you do deliberately. That may be also true.
Could it be said that, you know, ideally we should not be creatures of habit at all?
No, you should be creatures of habit, but the trick is to control which habits you're creatures of. You know, to have good habits is a good thing. Like a person habituates himself. You know, say the case of a minion. Someone that's an avid minion goer eventually gets up automatically. You know, time comes for minion, psht, you're out of there. That's a good thing. I'm not going to be a creature of that habit. Of course, sometimes we have this concept in Torah of mitzvahs anoshim lomdo, that there's such a thing as mitzvahs that become so habituated that you do them by rote, you lose sight of what you're doing and why you're doing.
Like breakfast that you say over and over.
Exactly. So you're automatically, you say Asher Yotzer. But it gets to the point that it's so automatic that it loses all meaning. You know, I used to have a group of people that were Bali Tshuva that I was teaching. So they basically would kind of bemoan the fact that when they go into shul, it was a whole big struggle to daven. And they sort of would say, they wish they could be like part of a shul and a member of a shul where everybody could daven with ease. So I used to say, in a way, you're better off this way, because this way you have to struggle. Every word is a little bit of is something you have to work at. So it's more likely to be meaningful to you. And I used to tell them, I mean, I never tried it. I don't know if I could actually do it, but I never tried it. But I said, I could probably bench from beginning to end and read the paper at the same time, and you could follow along in a bencher and I wouldn't make a mistake. And when I'm finished, I could tell you what this whole long article is about.
Wow.
Because the benching is so automatic without a bencher. And not just me, anyone that started benching at you know, beginning from when you could begin to read and do stuff like that, you can do it.
Is it
I said I could probably do how Rasvar did also and read the article.
What is that?
You know, the Sephardi pronunciation of the words. I mean, I could switch the pronunciation
really?
And also read an article at the same time. Not me, anybody. So it's a problem with habit that attacks somebody with good habits. But the good habits come to habitual. The same thing with going to shul. You go to shul all so automatically that it could become bereft of meaning. I know there was a rav in Brooklyn. He was supposedly a great Talmud Chacham. His name was Rabbi Yitzchak Pupko. So a friend of mine told me, Rabbi Yitzchak, he learned in Radin, in the yeshiva there, and he was quite, apparently quite familiar with the Chafetz Chaim. He had dealings with him, I don't know exactly what, but he told my friend that he remembers once entering the Chafetz Chaim's house. The Chafetz Chaim had a sefer open, and he was reading out of something out of the sefer with great enthusiasm. His whole being was into it. So he got closer. He said, "What was he reading?" He said, "He was reading Asher Yotzer." So he read it out of an open sitter.
Wow.
With great, great concentration and great involvement, great emotional involvement. So how many times a day do we say Asher Yotzer? Again, you could be reading the paper while you're doing it. There are halachas that you, as I recall, you don't say a bracha while you're holding something, while you're doing something. You're not supposed to because it's a distraction. But I remember I knew this religious guy who had a workaholic. And he told me that sometimes he goes to work in the morning and he davens while he's driving. And he just keeps driving. He davens, he knows how to daven the whole thing by heart. And he just stops while he's driving to work.
That's filling up.
Was filling, yeah. I don't know, maybe it could be that he had to go someplace in the afternoon and I asked him about Mincha, when he's going to daven Mincha. He said, "I'll say it while I'm driving." So it's wrong in halacha. It's very wrong in halacha, but it's just...
It seems very strange that a person would be benching and reading the paper.
I don't mean that I would do it.
But anything to be reading that's not...
Of course, it's usur. I never did it. I'm just saying, but the benching is so automatic to me and so easily said without having a thought that I could bench from beginning to end without thinking about what I'm saying for a second. Once you get that talent to bench like that, so the fact that you have the talent creates the greater temptation to do it that way.
It's strange how the brain can process the Hebrew and then English at the same time.
I don't know if I ever tried it. I never tried it. But I used to say to them that I probably could, and that it's not a sign of erudition or anything. It doesn't mean that I'm such a smart fellow. It doesn't mean that I'm knowledgeable. Any yeshiva kid from New York that's been taught to bench at the age of five, so if they're 45, so they've been benching once or twice a day for 40 years, then they bench doing almost anything and not think about it for a second. That's the way it is. So the fact that you are so accustomed to it is a drawback at times. And I'm just pointing out because you asked me, does habit, the force of habit, is it a good thing? Is it a bad thing? Sometimes it's a good thing if it's a good thing, but even if it's a good thing, it can also be a bad thing because the force of habit to do a good thing can desensitize you to what you're actually doing. Anyway, okay, so let's read a little bit here. Okay, so now he's again going and giving examples here of this idea that when you overload the stress on the Nefesh HaBahamas, it pushes you off and causes more problems than you had in the first place. So he says, B'maisa v'shnei anoshim rakim bashona, it happened with two young people, rakim bashona, like soft in years, meaning young people, shneim b'nei Torah yirei Elokim. They were both b'nei Torah, they both feared Hashem. Nosnu alibom hispalel b'kavanos perush amilos. that they made up that they're going to daven, and exactly the example I was just giving. They made up that they're going to daven and have the words in mind. Vechud hoya bal seichel charif. One of them was a very sharp intellect, umizgo cham, and he was, like, mizgo means his measurement was hot, meaning he was like, he was full of emotions. V'yochid l'aviv l'imo, he was an only child to his mother and his father, meaning he was, you know, he was fawned on, you know, like he thought himself as being a special person. And his halva yira b'libo pisom, and this lava, the fear of Hashem, burned within him suddenly. Lenos nafsho b'chol kochel, to force himself with all of his strength. Ligmar kol tefilosof, to finish all of his prayers. Belishum psig machshav azara, without any like trace of an alien thought. Himridol of Yitzro, his Yetzer Hara rebelled against him.
Can you explain that? Why that was?
Because it was too much of a demand against his modus vivendi of that time, like his way of doing things and what he was, his personality at that time. It was like if you made up that you're gonna say if a person, say for example a guy's retired, so he has 7 hours a day of not doing anything, and he never learned for more than a half an hour a day. So he made up he's going to spend 4 hours a day of learning, just like that. So the demand is just too intense, and it'll cause an opposite reaction. This is what he's been talking about, that this opposite reaction that's fostered by making too dramatic and too impossible a demand.
It says he's bright, he's got really strong Yirat Shemayim, he's strong Kavana in his Tefila. I guess it can happen to anybody, but you'd think he's kind of protecting himself.
No, but he made up to force himself with every bit of his energy to have total Kavana in his Tefila. And he didn't do it. It's like, we daven. How often do you have total Kavana in your Tefila? So the way to do it is using his basic understanding of the matter would be, maybe I'll have him kavana the first bracha of Shmon Esrei. And I get up in the morning and I'll say, no matter what, I'm going to have that first bracha of Shmon Esrei. No matter what. And you remind yourself 10 times, and it's going to be times that you don't do it, and this and that. After maybe 4 months, you get to the point that it starts becoming automatic, and you could do the first bracha of Shmon Esrei. Then already you've done something. Well, maybe you can go proceed to the second, or whatever it is, proceed to Ashrei, like that. But this guy just got up and said, I'm going to do it all at once. And he was, a passionate guy. So he said, V'himridol of Yitzro, and his Yetzer Hara rebelled against him. Fismarmer who connecto ozielser. I don't know word exactly what the word ismarmer means, but it probably means that he girded himself even more, like he became even more determined to break the Yetzer Hara that wouldn't let him do it. So like he invested everything that he had into it. The kachoisama hamuchomo koleches vegoveris benafsho. And so the war went and became more intense within his soul, meshech kama chadoshim, over a period of several months, atche nitrifa daito olav, till his head went like got nuts on him. Uchol pam shoye magia laskaras Hashem betfilaso, and whenever he got to mention Hashem's name in his tefila, because important parts of davening with kavanah is that when you say Hashem's name, you have in mind for what it means. It's So it got to the point, every time he got to Hashem's name, Nishtabesh Lahazker Shem Avodah Zarah V'Mekomo. He would recite, he made the mistake to mention an Avodah Zarah in its name. Like he was saying, Baruch Atah Jesus, something like that. And he got to that point that he lost it. He just totally became nuts from the stress of forcing himself to do something that was basically not doable. And it just kept going, like he wouldn't give up. He was so determined. Right? And then Vasheni Hoya Balsecho Mosun. The second one was a Balsecho of Mosun, means like measured, Miyushav Bativo, settled in his nature. Amoritz Bnei Bechruso, he was ignorant in his youth. Vichiskil Ahargil Atzmo Lutoro Lavoda Mahatmat. And he trained himself to get used to Torah and Avodah and serving Hashem, like davening little by little, Achibah Bashonim, until he got older, Loma Torah Harbe, he ended up learning a lot of Torah, V'nisparseim L'Talmud Chochum Choshuv V'Iro, he became known in the city as the Choshuv Talmud Chochum, Tom V'Yosher B'Maisov, he was fine and straight in his Vimaso, Matnon and Mabrios, and his dealings with people, with Filoso Barura Min Machshav Zara. And his prayers were clean of alien thoughts. Ukeshinishal Alza, Minain Zuchisulakach, and when they asked him about this, from what did you do to deserve this? Veheshiv, and he answered, Zakama Vakama Shonim, that it was many years, Shekibalti Alai, that I accepted upon myself lahargil esatzmi, that I to accustom myself lahachzik esdaiti v'machshava achas, to focus my thoughts on one thought, to focus my intellect on one thought, divrei Torah or tefillah, whether it be prayer or Torah or studying Torah, meshach zman ma, a certain amount of time. Like he said, for years he would work on ability to focus for a certain amount of time. And then after a certain amount of, large number of days, he succeeded. Then I got to the point where I could do it for an hour straight. He died with a good name. And he left over a very nice commentary on the Shulchan Aruch, Bracha Acharav, and a blessing after him.
What does it mean to you when he says focusing his mind on a single thought, either Torah or prayer? Well, what does that mean exactly?
I think it means is that he could go for 15 minutes without being distracted. Because the problem with davening usually is that, let's say you say something, and then 5 minutes later, you're well past that in the davening, and you haven't thought about what you were saying. So the mind that focused at one point, let's say you focused on Ashrei, and then in the middle of Ashrei, you lost focus, and then you refocused by Shema. Well, what happened to everything in between? Well, you know, you had other thoughts on your mind. There was an old European Jew that... In the place where we used to live, so he was very knowledgeable about Hasidus. He knew a lot of stuff about. It was quite a Talmud Chacham, and he was knowledgeable about many of the classical Hasidic tales. So, and wise words of wisdom. So he once told me that the story about the Kutzker Rebbe, who was known for his very sharp responses and his very sharp insights. So there was a shaila there of tov sakum, that when a goy makes a mistake and gives you something, and he didn't mean to, but he made a mistake. So the question is, do you have to give it back or not? So there's a lot to be said about it, but one of the criteria is, will the goy know about it? If he's going to find out, it's going to be a Chol Hashem. So, aside from everything else, you can't make a Chol Hashem. So he said it was a mistake and a calculation, and he said he doesn't think that the goy realized it. So the Kotzker Rebbe said, don't worry, he won't realize it, because he doesn't daven Shmon Esrei. That's what the Kotzker Rebbe said. He's a goy, he doesn't daven Shmon Esrei. Meaning that when a Jew daven Shmon Esrei, you know, all kinds of thoughts come into your mind. So you might get in, you get involved and start thinking about the business deal, and you'll reason, you'll realize that there was a mistake. So he says, this is goy, he doesn't daven Shmon Esrei, he's not going to think about it, don't worry, you know. That was what he...
there was a story, I thought you were going to tell the story about the Rebbe who, I think he went for a dry cleaner or something, and he pulled up in his car to actually, in person, give the owner, who was a goy, back the money that was, I guess, over 8 or 100 paid, whatever. And he made an effort to do a
Kiddush
Hashem in that way.
Yeah. The basic halacha is that there's basic halacha is that if he's not going to know, you don't have to give it back, as I recall. But there's a Be'er Hagola, it's one of the commentaries on the Shulchan Aruch, who's actually the grandfather of the Vilna Gaon. So he writes, he said he saw people that became enriched by such mistakes, and he said in the end they always lost their money. So it was like a curse. He said, you should never keep money like this. He said, don't. So, you know, basically, could be that this guy was a terrible guy, and, you know, he was a cruel person, and he was stealing money, and, you know, that they didn't feel that. If he didn't realize it, the Chedek will give him the money back. Because he was stealing much more than the mistake that he, you know, I don't know what the case was, but the example that he gave is just cute, because he said, you know, he doesn't daven Shmon Esrei, so he's not going to think about it, because the Yetzer Hara, you know, with the closest access to Hashem, which is the Shmon Esrei, the Yetzer Hara is strongest, and it gets you, it comes to you when you're doing Shmon Esrei to think about all kinds of different things. So he said that this person, what he did was, is that he made up for a short duration of time that he would concentrate. And he didn't budge until that amount was assimilated into his personality, and then he was able to continue. That is similar to his descriptions of training the elephant. You know, because you train the elephant, and little by little, you get him to do X, then to Y, and then Z, and so on and so forth. So.
My favorite story for the Shmon Esrei is the one where, you want to hear it?
Yeah, let's go. Let's
okay.
Go. Yeah, okay. Later. Mm-hmm. Not on the tape.
Yeah, the Rambam talks a lot about ethics and moderation. I mean, what we've just been learning about the two students and why the first student failed sounds exactly like what the Rambam says when he says, do things in moderation. Don't, if you have a choice of extremes, choose the middle path. You know, don't...
Well, that's a little... I don't know if that's exactly comparable. I'm not sure.
Can I ask you a question?
I don't think it's...
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah. Just a second. See, the Rambam is more talking about the character traits, I think, as I recall. Probably thinking about the Rambam, he says it in the Shmona Prakim in the 8 chapters, introduction to the Pirkei Avos. He talks about it, I think, in the basic Halacha Sefer in Yad HaChazaka. So he says that the character traits should not be extreme. So he said excess or paucity of their expression is what basically makes up a lack of psychological health. That when a person is psychologically ill, so what happens is that the character traits are too extreme or too deficient. He said mental well-being constitutes the character traits being the way they are. Let's say someone is very kind. So kindness is a virtue. But excessive kindness beyond the pale, beyond what should be done, then already that becomes a characterological illness, which could be devastating, and depending on how serious he gets, you know, you have to get it in the normal, or too little of it is also bad. The right amount is like people get kindness, they get so caught up in causes that they all, you know, forget about their family, they forget about their business, they forget about their life. So it's too much of a good thing, and then that causes psychological imbalance.
So this guy, the first Torah student, or Phila student here, he was putting all his energy into one extreme.
Yeah.
So in a sense, that's it sounds like he's not balanced.
Right, well, he wasn't balanced, but it wasn't really a character, a midah, it wasn't a character trait. Rambam is talking more about character traits. This was more like the service of Hashem. He attempted too much service of Hashem for what he was. That's not quite a character trait. It's like, I'm going to daven with kavana. I'll daven when I say my prayers, it'll be with intense concentration. So much so that it caused a bad reaction, that he was thinking about, you know, Avodah Zarah or whatever. At the end, when it was all over, whereas the other guy took an attainable goal and worked at it till he attained it, and then went to the next level at all, and so on and so forth.
So, it's a halacha, I believe, that you're not supposed to be overly righteous. Right. So, would that be this particular example, or any? Would that be the generalized rule? Then, I mean, that when you don't do things that are to an extreme. What does it mean to be overly righteous? I used to know. There's a certain halacha that they give as an example, but I can't remember what it is.
Yeah, I also have vague recollections of such a thing. It escapes me right now.
Yeah, but I think that, I mean, that's a problem I ran into personally, was I tried to be so by the, so sort of like frum about things, especially so by the book, you know, that it ended up interfering with my avodas Hashem, my service
with God. Well, that's exactly what he's talking about.
I mean, I don't blame myself. I think it's more of my teachers that misled me.
So since I don't know who your teachers you're referring to, we can talk about it.
I think I'm not naturally a balanced person. I think I was just instilled with too doctrinaire kind of dogma religion.
I don't know. But anyway. Okay, so let's do a little bit, another paragraph here, which keeps going on the same track. So 17. Umaisim b'chol yom, it happens every day, b'zmanenu, in our time, b'avonoseinu harabim, because of with our great numbers of sin, b'anoshim yukorim, with precious, dear people, shenichun beish hayira, that are burned by the fire of fear, meaning the fear of Hashem, bimei resichas mezeg bachurasam, in the days of their youth, you know, when they're very passionate, you know, the very extreme, kishnechpozim lakor l'shar sheyetzer har b'mehera, when they're rushing to uproot the Yetzer Hara in a hurry, la'abed zichro, and to banish his memory of the Yetzer Hara, mitoch kimte levavim, from the folds of their heart. Sofan, in the end, reshtakin b'mor shchora, they end up sinking into depression, v'shimum hadas, and the craziness of mind. Dahainu misas nefesh hasichel shalohem. That is the death of their nefesh hasichel, you know, their seichel, their intellect. Midras lapil. They become a mat for the elephant to stomp on. Alkain, there, you know, I could tell you that my Rebbe once told us the story that. His father was his Rebbe, and his father, you know, somehow he managed to raise a very exceptional child. He was very beloved, to my Rebbe. He was himself was one of the great people of the yeshiva system of Eastern Europe. See, Rebbe told me that once when he was about 15, 16, his parents gave him money to go buy a suit for Yom Tov or something like that, or just needed a suit. So he came back with a black suit. So his father sort of said, "Don't be so frum," and he sent it back to the store to exchange it for a suit that wasn't black. He said, "A kid that age doesn't have to have a black suit." You know, felt it was like jumping the gun on trying to make himself frum in a way that wasn't wholesome and wasn't consistent. You know, now in certain circles, everybody wears a black suit. You know, like the baby has a black outfit because he wants to be frum. I'm just joking about the baby, but like kids, little kids wear black suits. But in those times, you look at your pictures. This is, I guess, probably in the 1920s. Maybe it was like the early 1930s. So if you look at the pictures of yeshivas from those times, look at the yeshivas, even in yeshivas in great yeshivas in Eastern Europe. Let's say you see the picture of the Slovakia yeshiva, or the Mir yeshiva, or the Telz yeshiva. They used to have these pictures with tiny little faces in them. So they had like 400 faces. So you see, nobody had a beard, and nobody was dressed in black. And nobody. There are biographies of some of the great rabbis of those times when they were in yeshiva, the ones that came to America, like for example Rabbi Huttner. Rav Huttner was the Rosh Yeshiva of Chaim Berlin. So it became a very prominent yeshiva with many great talmidim, and he was a great Rosh Yeshiva, and his talmidim tend to wear black hats, and many of them wear long coats on Shabbos, and they wear gartels. But if you see a picture of Rav Huttner when he was in yeshiva, so he's got a huge head of hair, and a light gray suit, and a fancy collar, and a real slick tie. That's what he looked like when he was in yeshiva. So that was the time that we're talking about.
So beard or no?
No, beard. Are you kidding? He had a big head of hair, with a head of hair like that. No one could get into a top flight yeshiva high school in New York with hair like that. No one could, no matter who you are, even if you're Rav Huttner. But he was at an advanced level of learning. There are pictures of him in Hebron in the early 1930s. He went with Slabodka to Hebron. That's what he looked like. So in that time, for a kid to wear a black suit, who was considered an outrage. Well, he was fired up. He said it, and teenagers get very extreme, and they get all worked up. He said he got all worked up, and this was his father put his foot down. He said, "Not about this. Not this way. This is improper." So this is what he's talking about here. He said that they get so worked up that if they're not directed, they fall into depression. And I've seen this with my eyes. I've seen, people in yeshiva, they get so worked up with trying to reach ever greater heights of hasmada, dedication to learning, and frumkeit, and this and that, that the end is that they end up being depressed.
But there's a lot of talk that, people who became tzaddikim were able to basically neutralize their yetzer hara. So it's a goal that people have.
Yeah. You should know that one of the great disservices to Judaism, in my humble opinion, has been this proliferation of books about great people that are sanitized to the point that their humanity is omitted from them.
Most of them put out by art school.
I'm familiar with cases of people that were involved with biographies and they people there were uproars from people because certain things that these great people did as younger people were included. I remember there was this very famous stink about this book that came out, The Making of a Gadol. So there were some things in there that were uncomplimentary about someone, a great Rav, when he was younger. And there was a book that came out that was written by a great person. It was written by the person who wrote the Torah Tumima. You know, that Chumash Torah Tumima that every bar mitzvah boy gets three sets of. That Chumash Torah Tumima was written by somebody, and I think his name was Baruch Halevi Epstein. And he was a Talmud of Halashen, and he was a nephew of the Rosh Hashiva of Halashen of the Netziv. So he wrote this beautiful biography of his uncle, called Makor Baruch. But like a real biography, it describes some of the issues that were going on and some of the things that he did or that he said that wouldn't fit with today's perception of how he should have been. You know, it's like so like the news, the way the press reports the news, sometimes they report what they want to be have taken place rather than what actually took place. So he reported what actually took place. So there was an outcry when Art School translated the Makor Baruch into English that certain parts of it had to be sanitized, it had to be removed. And I actually was talking to my Rebbe about I don't know, that case, something like that. And I remember saying to him, I said, it's a good thing these guys didn't write the Chumash. Because if they did, a lot of the Chumash would be missing. You know, we have the story about Yosef and Potiphar's wife, and you have stories about Moshe Rabbeinu sinning. It was a bad enough sin that he didn't go to Eretz Yisrael for it. We have issues of Avram with his lack of faith, and because of which the Jews had to go to Egypt. These are major, major problems that they were involved with. Yitzchak erred by on some level choosing Esav over Yaakov. So I said, if these guys applied the same standards, we would have a whole different Chumash. So he agreed with me. He said, yeah, of course. I mean, if you read the books of these Gedolim and some of these biographies, they all had fewer travails throughout their lives than the seven Ushpizen that we have on Sukkos. You know, the seven great people of Avram, Yitzchak, Yaakov, Yosef, Moshe, Aaron, and David. They all have things that they're all things about them that the Chumash relates that are just not, that wouldn't get into an art scroll book, you know, or that type of book. So, it's a disservice because it fills you up with these unrealistic impressions of what they're like, and then you can't function because you can't be like that. It's demoralizing at the very least. Anyway, so let's just finish this paragraph. So it says he's Midrash Lapil. He becomes the mat for the elephant to stamp on. Therefore, we have to put all of our hopes, Baharomos Shoganevas Dasa Bahamas, in tricks to deceive the animal-like thoughts within us, Vcholmine Tachbulos, and all types of tricks, Shomalechas Chinuch Amidos Bulvad, through the science of training Midos alone, and that's what we've got to do. Okay? Have a good day. Have a good evening.
You too.
Okay.